You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hello, Leron. How are you?
Hey, Bob. All right. This is the first episode of potentially a new series, huh?
Conceivably. This is an experiment. It's a joint production between our podcasts, My Non-Zero, Your Doom Debates. And we are hopeful that the experiment is going to warrant repeating. Yes.
Yeah, exactly. So viewers, welcome Doom Debates viewers as well. Doom Debates Non-Zero Mashup. I think this is a point in time where anybody who has a background in analyzing what the heck is going on is needed, right? I think there's a call to arms for people like us, right? And we're being pressed into service.
Yeah. I should specify for my audience that we're talking about artificial intelligence, because not all of my podcasts focus on that. Although, since I published a book on AI called The God Test a mere 2.5 months ago, although it seems like longer, a lot of my podcasts have been about AI. And for that matter, no few were before that. You've been on my podcast several times, to great effect. You were kind enough to have me on yours talking about my book. So, yeah. And I guess the idea behind this is just stuff is just happening so fast that sometimes you feel like you need a rapid reaction. And it would be nice to have somebody you could call and say, maybe we should talk.
Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, both of our backgrounds go pretty deep. I know you were covering Deep Blue, Garry Kasparov, even AI before that, right? So you've got the multi-decade background. I've got a multi-decade background as an Eliezer Yudkowsky reader. I started reading Yudkowsky in 2007. Before that, I studied computer science in college. I was doing AI adjacent things for fun. You know, I have a deep computer science background. So, you know, we have some context looking at the present, but the present is already kind of like its own runaway thing.
Yeah, I think both of us in different ways over the last week or few weeks have probably had the experience that, wow, the world is kind of catching up with my worldview. I mean, you know, you have been, I think it's fair to say, a doomer in some sense of the word for quite a while. And I, largely in the course of writing this book, became more and more concerned about the direction of AI. I'm not a classic Yudkowsky doomer, but I don't think you can dismiss the sci-fi doom scenarios. And I think there's a lot of other things to worry about, including just social destabilization and geopolitical destabilization. And all things point to the wisdom of slowing things down and trying to govern this technology with care.
And very true.
And isn't it kind of a weird feeling for you to suddenly look around and go, wait, all these people agree with me? What's going on?
Yeah, that I think you're fast forwarding all the way to like yesterday, right? So but putting a pin in that, just going back to 2024, that was when you invited me on your show for the first time, and it helped precipitate. That was like a month before I'm like, hey, I'm just going to do Doom Debates. I'm just going to do my own show so I can, you know, keep sounding off. But back in 2024, I think you were very focused on the objection. The reason why you wanted to talk to me and the Yudkowskians is like, okay, yeah, you guys have a lot of good ideas. You know, AI is going to be big. It seems like ChatGPT is having a moment. But your sticking point was like, okay, but how, you know, what's really going to happen? And I think maybe that's still your sticking point, right? That's still the reason why you don't call yourself like a full-on Yudkowskian.
One thing I'd say is I'm seeing a lot of that online on Twitter. A lot of people are asking this question. A lot of people who are finally focusing on the doom question but are not converted are saying, look, show me a scenario. And I still do think there is not a super straightforward, accessible scenario that anyone sketched out. I didn't find that in Eliezer's book. I mean, he did a scenario, but I think it was almost, you know, unintelligible to a layperson. And now, I will say the OpenAI breakout of however long ago, I mean, we keep learning more about it, so it still almost seems a current story. I think that has helped people fill in some blanks who just weren't buying the idea that even in principle, this stuff could get out of control in any meaningful sense.
Right. I think that's definitely contributing to the vibe shift, you know, the hacking, because when it's hacking, it's like, oh my God, it did something, right? Like it took agency. Mm-hmm. It went into an agentic loop and it escaped. Whereas from my perspective, back in 2023, when I saw ChatGPT, I'm like, oh, okay, it's completing the pattern of what code should look like. And in my mind, I'm like, yeah, code is executable, right? It's like, if you know what code to write, you can run the code, okay? Like, it's not there. I didn't see a big distinction where it's like, oh, some angel has to come and breathe the agency into it. I was like, nope, it's just a matter of knowing what to do. If you know what to do, you can do it, right? But now we're actually seeing it. And I think there's been another breakthrough also with the math now. I think that's psychologically adding to people where it's like, oh yeah, we said that only humans could like make math breakthroughs, right? Now the AI is breaking through. It's surpassing us. It's not just imitating us. I think those might be the two biggest psychological changes.
Yeah, and I would add something to what you said about agency. And this, I kind of, I got this in my book at the last minute when Claude Cowork was becoming a thing. And I was kind of thinking about, well, what really is happening here that's different from what happened before? And I realized, actually, Claude was the first one to explain this to me, that, you know, it isn't just code. If you look at kind of anything you would want an AI to actually do out there in the world online, you could view it as a series of cognitive activities separated by chain, connected by chains of code. So in other words, like if you just want it to like, okay, read these resumes, triage them, and then go out online and search to do more research on them, and then forward the most promising ones to so-and-so in the company. Well, there's a couple of things there that you need tools to do. They're not acts of pure cognition. You know, an LLM per se cannot send an email. You need either a pre-existing tool or to write the code, and the pre-existing tool is code. So that, to me, is a helpful thing to say to lay people, including myself, kind of, that once you've got bursts of cognition by super smart machines where they can do assessment and analysis, and you can connect those with code, it's not that easy to imagine things that can't be done.
Totally. The thing is that even people who work at OpenAI seem to be a little bit delusional about this stuff. What strikes me is a few weeks back, you know, the Hugging Face incident and their talk that they did at, was it Black Hat was the conference? And they were saying like, look, we isolated it. Okay. It was supposed to be air gapped, but it wasn't really air gapped. There was a package manager server that was internal to OpenAI. And that server was allowed to talk to the internet. Okay. Mm-hmm. So it's still connected by an internet cable to a server that's also connected by an internet cable to the larger internet. That's called being connected to the internet. Okay. By the transitive property. But they're like, no, but it's that, you know, it was just supposed to load packages. Right. But they exploited the thing. Okay. They hacked it. So even OpenAI has like a profound lack of imagination in terms of like, right. You know, how easy the game is for these
AIs. And it was already should have been clear to them, like if they couldn't figure out a way to get out of the sandbox, that's not enough, because we know that these coders are better than them, right? So you know, you just gotta prepare for the worst, kind of. Maybe we should start with this thing that, like you said, I just like to put a pin in kind of yesterday, and then connect all these dots, and maybe we have different ideas about how exactly the momentum has built towards such a kind of a zeitgeist shift. And I should say, what is the zeitgeist shift? A whole lot more people are talking out loud about the need for not just regulation, but international coordination to slow things down and then kind of govern the stuff on a planetary basis, almost. And I would say, like, the last couple of days, the big thing, this got a huge amount of attention, of course. This guy at Anthropic, he'd been Anthropic maybe a couple of months, but at OpenAI before that, his name is Jacob Cox. And he said, I resigned from Anthropic today. I spent the last 3 years pre-training research at both OpenAI and Anthropic. Neither company is acting responsibly. They are racing straight to self-improving superintelligence and gambling with our lives. More thoughts below. Then he says some more stuff, and he says the people in these companies, they earnestly believe that it could kill us all by the end of the decade. And then I think what really catalyzed it was this guy, Evan Hubinger at Anthropic, who is apparently the alignment science lead there, chimed in and said, and this, by the way, this is what the BBC led with this morning. They didn't lead with a resignation. They led with this alignment lead at Anthropic said. He said, Jacob is correct here. We really do earnestly believe AI could kill all humans. I personally think it is greater than 10% within the next decade. I believe Anthropic is trying its best, but we do not yet have a plan to solve alignment for superintelligence and are not clearly on track to. Now, this episode here, it was not the only thing that happened. You could feel zeitgeist changes in the preceding weeks, but don't you kind of agree that this was almost felt like the crest of a wave or something?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, so something broke, right? It's kind of like a preference cascade. I would call it a belief cascade mm-hmm. where I think what happened was there was a lot of people outside our bubble, like people in government, and they'd been hearing all these rumors, all these signs, and they're getting worried, or some of them have been worried for years, but there's like an Overton window thing. And actually, you know, Dean Ball, God bless him, he's sure good at following the political winds, right? Because he, I think it was like 2 weeks ago now, right, that he issued that statement where, or he issued a very interesting post where he's like, guys, I got to come clean. I've always known, or I've known for a while, that there's going to be these swarms of AIs loose on the internet that we can't control. This is a thing. I just want to give you guys a heads up because I know it, and it's kind of a mea culpa. I should have said it earlier. I'm saying it now. Why didn't I say it earlier? Because I thought people weren't ready to hear it. Or he said at the end, he's like, or, you know, maybe I didn't let myself think it. You know, some combination of the two. Mm-hmm. But anyway, I'm saying it now. Like, that was Dean Ball. And I'm like, okay, that's interesting, right? And then like 10 days later, it's like, bam, the dam's breaking. Everybody's like, all these different Congress people, I have a big list of them we can go through. They're all saying, oh my God, we need AI regulation. Like, even though the US should lead, we need to regulate. So it's kind of funny. Dean Ball was kind of like, you know, a little bit ahead of the pack.
And we should say, kind of for my podcast audience, you know, he was a Trump guy. He was the main author probably behind Trump's big AI report, a libertarian historically, and has historically sounded like he wasn't that worried. In light of his kind of coming out of the closet as an actual worrier, I want to go back and re-listen to a conversation he had with Nathan Labenz on Nathan's Cognitive Revolution podcast, because I remember listening to it and thinking, wait, there's just too many contradictions here. On the one hand, you're saying this, but on the other hand, you're not that worried. I was just thinking, I want Dean Ball on my podcast to confront him with the internal contradictions. And it turns out he knew they weren't actual internal contradictions. Some of it just wasn't true. Or I don't want to be too hard on him, Dean Forrest. What's that?
Yeah, he came on my podcast too in late 2025. He debated Max Tegmark. Very interesting episode. You know, that episode represents the finest achievement that Doom Debates is striving for. You know, get prominent people to debate each other. Unfortunately, I haven't been able to do as much of that as I would like. Everybody refuses to come on the show and debate each other. It's a problem. But Dean Ball and Max Tegmark, to their credit, they absolutely did it. And what I remember Dean Ball saying, he was very clear. He's like, oh yeah, recursive self-improving or superintelligence. Yeah, we're not planning for that. Like we just wrote a policy. He was in the Trump administration. He helped write the policy that was all about artificial general intelligence, but not superintelligence and not recursive self-improving. Like, yeah, we're just planning like a little bit ahead. We're not trying to go like crazy projecting the future. Well, a few months pass. He is now an employee of OpenAI. OpenAI is being very clear that they're on the verge of recursive self-improvement. It's like life comes at you fast.
Mm-hmm. And Anthropic did that paper a few months ago saying they were getting not that far from recursive self-improvement, you know, where the point where there's just literally no human in the loop, the AI is playing such a large role in the creation of the generation, next generation of AI, and it's already playing a pretty big one, that it, you don't need the people. The AI just keeps making better versions of it, of itself. That is strict recursive self-improvement. And Anthropic flagged it a few months ago, and it's become a pretty well-known term. I don't want to be too hard on Dean Ball. Almost everyone in the world, including myself, sometimes kind of, you know, trims their sails a little, isn't fully forthcoming about everything they believe. But it does sound like this was a more robust than average case of sail trimming. I don't know how I would put it. And it served him well.
I mean, I don't want to single him out because there's so many people that I consider worse, right? So it's like, why pick on him? I thought it was interesting. It was certainly upfront, right? And he certainly gets some credit for changing his mind in public. So yeah, I find him an interesting case, but I wouldn't dogpile.
And I don't think you should give people really strong negative reinforcement for doing that, because you want people to do that. You want people to say, I was wrong, or wasn't fully, you know, forthcoming or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, I would love for this would never happen. But I remember a very prominent voice in 2023, when people started getting worried, was Mark Andreessen and Andreessen Horowitz, right? They were calming everything down. They're like, guys, I know you've heard all these people at these AI companies saying that we're doomed and P-doom is high. I'm here to tell you that it's not. Because here's my argument. It's just math. You know, you can't outlaw math. And also, he made all these bad arguments. Like, I've actually enumerated the bad arguments, but he said stuff like, look, if the AI is so smart that it's smarter than humans, it's smarter than human programmers, why would it have a bug saying to be bad? Like, that would be one of his arguments. And it's like, but it's not a bug from its perspective, right? Like, from its perspective, it's like, yep, kill everybody, looks good, right? So anyway, so there are all these bad arguments. Like, I've heard murmurings now from A16Z. They've been tweeting stuff, different employees there, different partners. They've been tweeting stuff like, hey, we've seen the latest OpenAI models and wow, this is, you know, these are pretty powerful things. And we're going to be talking to the government in terms of like, what's the proper regulations? It's like, okay, so it sounds like you're already doing a 180. Like, that's great. Maybe you can take the lead, but how about being explicit that you seem to have screwed up?
Yeah, the All On podcast is a good barometer. I kind of enjoy tuning in to see how their latest cope is coming. Generally, they just kind of ignore it. Like last week, they finally did mention the OpenAI breakout, but they're still saying these kinds of things. Kind of, these are computer programs. They're this, they're that. They're acknowledging that it was non-trivial, but yeah. It'll be interesting to see.
Yeah. I listened to that. I listened to it over the weekend, the All In podcast. I got to say, extremely disappointed. It feels like Jason Calacanis and David Sachs and Chamath are like a united front dismissing everything coming out of the AI companies with a high P doom, right? They're saying, oh, of course it's BS. Of course it's just IPO. Of course it's just regulatory capture. It's like, can you guys just like look at the argument again? This idea of super intelligence, right? There's like zero take. Although sometimes I see, occasionally they do pay some lip service to it, right? Like I've seen David Sachs tweet in the past being like, why would you make a super intelligent God? You know, you shouldn't do that. But then it's like, he hasn't mentioned that because he's so focused on the business side of it. So I would love to break through to the All In podcast. Like, I don't think there's much time for them to continue ignoring
the issue. I offered my services to David via DM. I haven't heard back. He was on my podcast a long time ago before he was a White House AI czar. It was then, before he was White House AI czar, he did have a tweet, I think since deleted, that said something like, you know, AI is fine, but AGI, I think he was just saying artificial general intelligence, not even super. You know, then at that point, you're talking about a successor species. Like, that's another, I'm not, you know, and he was, but he's kind of changed his tune. You know, it's interesting. He left the White House some months ago, and I'm still unclear on why. I mean, technically, they say it was, well, the technical rules governing his appointment as a temporary this or that dictated that he leave. Well, come on, the Trump administration pays no attention to rules. That can't be the reason. And I wonder whether it was becoming obvious enough to them that the strict hands-off libertarian approach to AI was becoming unpopular even within parts of MAGA, that they wanted to get some distance between the White House and him. I don't know what the story is. And it'll be interesting to see what the White House does in the future in light of the zeitgeist shift. They started going through the motions of model, you know, clearing. That's voluntary, but I think they cleared Astra without asking any questions to speak of, so far as I can tell.
It is interesting because Daniel Cocatello had a good take on this. I just heard him on Joe Rogan. He was saying, look, this White House is dynamic, right? So like they'll take a position, but then like Trump will listen to somebody else and they will turn on a dime. So it's interesting what's coming next out of Trump.
Yeah. And I should say, although I think, we need government evaluation of models, pre-release evaluation. The way the Trump administration has done it, which is just to assert that he has the right to do it and he's the president, and so it's going to happen, that does not make me comfortable. I mean, you want to be careful about who you give the power, this kind of power to, and I would like to see Congress develop a whole structure that, you know, for doing this in a careful way so that you're not subject to the whims of a given president in terms of which models, you know, get clearance and which don't. But we'll see.
Mm-hmm. All right. Here's going back to this idea of the news roundup, right? So we were talking a few days ago. We're like, hey, let's do a news roundup show. You know, let's try this. And you were like, you know, there's been some incidents with Hugging Face. Let's circle back in like 5 or 6 weeks when there's more news. I'm like, think it's going to be faster than 5 or 6 weeks, right? And then from there, we proceed to like the most intense, potentially the most intense, or like top three most intense AI news weeks, right? And we're still like halfway through the weeks. I think just to run down stories off the top of my head, we had the German wiki story. So that broke last Friday, right? So it's like, oh, hey, OpenAI has all these other swarms. And this was another security incident. What's stuck in my mind is, yeah, they only let it do HTTP GET, but it just searched the internet and it found a wiki that when you do HTTP GET, which is supposed to be read-only, that particular wiki just treats that as an instruction that you can use to write. So they were writing to each other. So it broke security that way.
So that was another message board. Was that the use they put that? It was an obscure wiki, but that's what they were doing. They were communicating with each other.
That's right. Yeah, they were communicating and they were solving exercise. I think it was information lookup exercises. So the idea is like you have to like research a subject and then you're going to get like a short time limit after you do your quote unquote studying. You get like a short time limit to answer the next question. Mm-hmm. But they collaborated on this message board and they're like, hey, some of us have no hope, but look, we'll post the answers for you guys. And then the next agents to come along, you guys are going to get a higher score. But you guys are kind of on our same team. Like I'm helping myself get a higher score by helping my sibling get a higher score. You know, this is the kind of non-zero selection, non-zero sum transactions.
What was the overarching goal? I mean, we know what it was in the Hugging Face case to cheat and then cover their tracks. But what was it in this case?
The goal was, it was a kind of knowledge test where you have like, I don't know, 20 minutes or something to quote unquote study where you can like ingest a bunch of knowledge. And then you're going to have, let's say 2 minutes where you get a test question and you have to use like whatever you've already figured out from your studying combined with like a little bit of thinking to answer the question. So they were all being set like one after the other, but then they were all helping each other.
So they were under evaluation, like the ones who broke into Hugging Face. They were doing a test for their overseers.
Yeah.
Okay. I didn't pay that much. Okay, so there's the German wiki. I mean, agents have just been more active on the internet than any of us imagined, apparently. What else?
Right, yeah. So that was last Friday. That was when the news broke. And of course, OpenAI, there's so much of this. Like OpenAI, as far as we can tell, they absolutely knew about this earlier. Mm-hmm. They knew about this during the independent Hugging Face / OpenAI hack investigation. They knew about it. And what did they do? They're like, hey guys, we're putting limits on what you can investigate. Here's like some Hugging Face data. Like, just don't go poking around anywhere else. Okay. Limit to Hugging Face. And of course, the whole time they were thinking, don't find out about the German wiki. Don't find out the extent of this. You know, let's try to limit the blast radius here of how bad we look in the news. But then the Meter team independently found somehow, like, look, they searched the web and they actually did tactics. Like they asked a copy of the AI. They're like, hey, if you were a rogue swarm on the web, like, where would you go? What would you do? Aha. Like that you actually did go there.
Yeah. So, then there's the kind of the chain of thought monitoring scandal, right? I don't know if I'm going in the correct chronological order, but at some point,
right? Yeah, yeah. Now you're pulling back from last week already. You know, that's already ages ago. But yeah,
well, I think it was Sunday. I think it was less than 7 days ago. I'm not sure, but well, it happened in two stages because this is another case. I think you tell me, you know more about this than I do, but I think there's another case of OpenAI not being fully forthcoming because I think this was originally reported in The Information, and that led, is it true that that's what led OpenAI's chief scientist to acknowledge that Astra, the most powerful released model, was less susceptible to chain of thought monitoring, which is, of course, a safety technique. You would like to be able to monitor the chain of thought and know what it's thinking. So he kind of admitted that after The Information reported it. Is that right?
Yes. I'm not sure the exact order of operations, okay? But the point is that somehow people realized that Astra is not doing a legible chain of thought because to get technical for the viewers. So when Astra is doing its thinking, it's allowed to just push a vector around in latent space. So you have like, a 1,000-dimensional vector. And normally you're supposed to use a vector like that to output a token, and the token is English, and a human is supposed to be able to interpret that token much the same way that the AI is going to interpret it itself. Mm-hmm. So the human has monitorability. It kind of sees where the AI's head is. But what's happening now is like, oh, I'm just going to do a bunch of linear transformations or a bunch of math on this vector within the high dimensional space. And I'm never going to output the token and feed the token back in. I'm just going to do this magic thinking that a human can't follow. And I'll output the token later once I've already done a bunch of thinking. And then the human's like, wait, are you like plotting against me during all this thinking? You know, like what kind of opaque thinking is happening? I don't know. I only have the output.
Right.
Right. And so that just makes deception extremely easy.
So just a little bit of AI 101 here, especially maybe for my audience. But I gather, so the original large language models before the chain of thought revolution, you could think of it as this bunch of layers of neurons that are interconnected. The neurons are interconnected in various ways. And tokens, which is to say mathematical representation of a series of words in the case of next token prediction, next word prediction, you know, they go in, you can think of them as going in at the top, but they're numbers, they're converted to numbers, they go all the way through, they're converted and converted and converted and according to various things, they come out the bottom. And then that's the next word prediction, okay? That's like plain vanilla. You take that token and turn it back into a word, and that's your next word prediction, and you make the model better and better at that in training. But I gather, and this is my question for you, Liron, that once chain of thought happened, what they were in effect doing was, before you get to a token that's actually the output per se, you still do kind of a version of that. You go through, you get a token, but you take the token, you put it back in. The token is just in a way a thought, and you take that token and put it back in, or maybe a series of tokens, and it runs through the process again and again and again. And eventually, after a certain amount of that thinking, you know, you're going to get a true output token that is, you know, a word or sentence or whatever. Is that a rough, before we get to like why these are not, before we review, but I asked a late person's version of the question of why they're not monitorable. Is that part kind of true? Kind of?
Yes, I mean, I'll try to review that. I'll give my own version of this explanation. Okay, so we start with 2023 GPT-3 or whatever. It's all about predicting the next token, because I think people might be confused. Wait a minute, large language models, didn't they just predict text tokens? How did we get into this new regime where now they're like thinking and doing stuff, right? Like, what was the step change exactly, right?
So
the way I understand it is, they started with predicting the next token. And the first advance was just this idea that you could literally just tell the model, think step by step, right? Even when it was still a next token predictor, because it turns out that when you ask somebody a question like, hey, here's a physics problem. How many seconds does it take for this projectile to hit the ground that I just fired out of a cannon? Right. How many seconds does it take? Well, if it has to give you the answer in one token, it's going to be like a human who has like half a second to answer your question. It's going to blurt out an answer. And there's a good chance that it just didn't have time or didn't have enough mental resources, right, to properly think all the thoughts that it would need in order to construct an answer. But if you say, hey, I want you to think step by step, write down everything you need to consider, write down all the implications of everything you know, and then eventually work your way to the answer. If you let it do that, even if it's still predicting the next token, one token at a time, it's got a better shot, because predicting an explanation one token at a time, the statistical connection to the next token, you can build a thread, right? A thread of thought that'll get you to the answer more robustly than trying to blurt out the answer right away. Mm-hmm. So that was like the very first step, right? Literally just the prompt, like show your chain of thought. And then they came up with this concept of a reasoning model where they're like, okay, we're not even just going to predict the next token. We're going to have this special mode called reasoning where you output a bunch of reasoning tokens. And the training of the reasoning process, there's going to be more secret sauce in the training, right? So we're going to have like examples of what it looks like when you do a good job thinking. And we're going to like upvote and downvote your thinking. I can't tell you exactly how it works because I'm not an expert. And also because now this gets into like the super proprietary stuff, right? Like this is when they stop publishing anything, right? So I can only just give you a vague, like, hey, they somehow reinforce the thinking. And now they're doing like RLVR. They're doing these new regimes where they're somehow bringing in the secret sauce from reinforcement learning when they're like, yeah, you're predicting the next token, but also when you eventually get the answer or get an output or get a score on the test, we're going to feed that back in how you update your weights. Right. So now you're getting feedback from the reality of how well you're accomplishing things. So, and that's like the bitter lesson, right? It's like different types of feedback. There's the next token feedback, and then there's the accomplishing things in reality feedback. It all goes together into these giant matrices, and it just spits out something that predicts tokens and gets things done.
Right. And so I gather, assuming my crude description is more or less on target, that when a chain of thought is legible, when you can read it, what that kind of means is that, you know, okay, it's going down and blah, 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 new token, but it's not true output. It feeds it back in, more thinking. So it's not true output, but you still, humans have access to it. And that's, and it, and they put those tokens together, I gather, that are kind of at the end of each cycle of thinking, you might say. And they have, and so they can see kind of what it was thinking along the way. And this became important in understanding the behavior of these agent swarms in the OpenAI breakout, right? We have some of their thinking. And now, go ahead.
Well, I mean, imagine you just have somebody who's really crafty, right? Like you just, I don't know, think of like a cloud, like Slick Willy or whatever, right? Like, I don't know, Bill Clinton trying to lie to Congress or whatever, right? Well, you know, Bill Clinton has a powerful mind, and you can imagine trapping in a room and not giving him time to think and being like, yep, you just have to, you always have to start answering immediately. In that case, he won't have much of an internal monologue. But let's say you say, you know what, Bill Clinton, you do get to think for a minute before you answer. Well, many of us have internal monologues that do show up in our stream of consciousness as English words. So if you could listen to a faithful rendition, like if you could tap into the audio loop going on in Bill Clinton's brain, there's a good chance that you could actually hear him, you know, talking to himself in his head. And that could actually be useful to help you know if he's lying. He'd probably be saying like, oh, I can't tell him this. Like if you literally could listen to his monologue, you'd probably catch him faster, right? So the analogy with AI is, we give them these internal monologues. Like the fact that they print out tokens is very analogous to a politician talking to themselves in words. The caveat is that sometimes humans and sometimes AIs get thinking done even without the internal monologue, right? Like they somehow get to secretly think anyway, right? And we all do that. Like some of us have had wordless insights and wordless thoughts. Like we all do that. And so it's not a fail-safe method, but it's still better than nothing. And OpenAI is like, let's just not have as many words.
Yeah, I'm not sure what they've owned up to, but the allegation is that they've been using a technique which I think is called something like recurrent depth or something that leads to less legible thinking. Anyway, that in the context of these super powerful models, to think that we're going to have less insight into what they're thinking is genuinely alarming. And this shouldn't be confused with the issue of training on chain of thought. Let's don't get into that, but that's not a good thing, apparently. But we would still like transparency into the chain of thought. And so apparently we're not getting that. And, you know, after this piece came out, I think in the information, this guy, Jacob something, who is the chief scientist at OpenAI.
Jacob Coxon.
Yeah. So different guy. Jacob, I think Jacob, it's like a Polish name or something. It's
Jacob Pachacki.
Yeah. So he wrote this thing acknowledging reduced chain of thought monitoring. I'm not sure he fessed up to what some people are saying happened, but in any event, he did that. And I want to say, to his credit, I'm very happy in a way about the outcome of this, because he comes out. In the end, is part of this zeitgeist shift, because he comes out saying he thinks we need an internationally coordinated slowdown, which is even a little more a little more robust than the famous Pacing the Frontier letter, which was, I'm trying to remember the timing. I think that was itself a product of the OpenAI breakout. And he probably signed that letter too. That was a lot of elites saying, well, the U.S. government, we recommend the U.S. government prepare the ground, start developing the policy and technical tools for internationally coordinated something in the event that something or other. What he said this time is stronger. He's saying, you know, it's time for international coordination on a slowdown. And that's good. That's good. So God bless him.
Yes. And by the way, what he was saying, I think, about recurrent depth is like, look, yeah, sure, we're chipping away at the monologue that we can listen in on, but we're only chipping away a little. I think an analogy would be like Bill Clinton gets to like have an internal monologue, but every time he whispers a couple words to himself, there's like a 1 second gap that you can't hear what's going on in his brain. And then you like hear it again and then you don't hear it. So like, look, it's still good. But I see on Less Wrong, people are saying, guys, Astra, you know, OpenAI's latest model, the one that's taking advantage of the opaque monologue, we're doing studies and we're showing that it can do a lot of thinking between the words. So it's like, great. All right. It's already opaque. And then you can ask the question like, well, don't we have mechanistic interpretability, right? So can't we just like listen anyway, even if it's not made out of words? And the answer is no. The answer is that mechanistic interpretability is primitive.
Yeah, and mech interp, as they say, that's my attempt to sound like an insider, is so interpretability is understanding these things. Mechanistic is like understanding. It's in a way, it's like a distinction between learning about the human mind through your classic psychology experiment involving questionnaires and blah, 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 where people just say things in response to conditions and you make inferences, between that and like neurology, like studying the brain, you know. With mech interp, I gather, they like to be able to point to patterns of neuronal activation and stuff and say, this is where it's happening. Is that more or less right?
Yep. Yes, that's basically mech interp. Now, I've always been a mech interp bear for a few reasons. Like, I don't think it's going to help as much, even if we had full chain of thought monitorability. It's like, okay, great. The AAs are like, at some point, okay, great. You can monitor the chain of thought. You can stop it when it's being evil. Okay, yeah. At some point, you're going to tell the AI to run a profitable business, and it's going to say, hey, I am going to now just go buy up everything, right? I'm going to amass power. I'm going to do effective marketing so that people support me. Like, it's going to do the standard instrumentally convergent things, right? They're going to show up in the chain of thought, and you're just going to look at it and be like, well, yeah, I mean, this is what you do when you want to consolidate power. Like, this looks fine. And the issue is not, like, the issue is not that the particular AI that we're building is going to show that it's malevolent. It's more like, as you often say, we're just going to regress to Darwinian competition between these AIs that move, play the chess game way faster than us, right? They do 20 moves before we can even start to think of our first move. And yeah, some of their chain of thoughts are just being like, I'm playing this game really hard right now. And we're going to be sitting there being like, ah, what is happening right now? I can't follow the news.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm a skeptic of, I'm a skeptic that the alignment project can be enough to save us. It may have some good consequences. It does tend to be a two-edged sword. I mean, alignment depends on interpretability as a rule. Like, the more you understand them in theory, the more you're supposed to be able to align them in with our values and interests. I just don't think, and all the evidence so far is nobody's ever made a completely aligned model. Anthropic admits that its models are faking stuff during its evaluations of them and so on. I just don't see how you ever catch up and keep us completely safe with that alone.
Yep. All right. Well, this brings us to, you know, just doing the news roundup. Okay. So everything we've said so far has been pretty interesting, pretty groundbreaking. And, you know, just a few things slip by, like the solving of the Navier-Stokes Millennium Prize problem. I guess we should touch on that.
It sounds like it's important. Now, you tell me, is this, I gather, bigger than like either solving this Erdos problem, which one of them did a couple of months ago, or this list of things OpenAI put out, this list of math accomplishments OpenAI put out maybe 6 weeks ago that was pretty impressive. I gather this is the biggest thing yet in math. Is that your sense?
I mean, there's a $1 million prize for it.
That's big.
that's
and there
good,
was
yeah.
a human mathematician who was kind of hot on the trail, right? And I'm not up on that story. But
yeah. Right. So from what I heard, it's like interesting drama where like humans were working on it and they were using AI to help. And I think one of the human researchers also currently works at Anthropic. And OpenAI caught wind that this was the project. And OpenAI was like, hey, you know, for the hell of it, why don't we just ask Astra to go work on this? And this is like, I heard it took 88 hours of Astra mostly just working independently.
Wait, is this Astra, or is this the unreleased?
Oh, sorry. This is an internal model.
Right. That's what's scary.
Right, I think it's unreleased model.
This already exists.
Right. Yeah,
and
the unreleased model.
Yeah.
Right. The internal model within OpenAI, I think Aeon is the code name for it, is a step above Astra. So OpenAI is 3 to 6 months ahead of what we see with Astra, and Astra is obviously quite impressive. So they took their internal model and they're like, hey, work on the Navier-Stokes problem. And sure enough, within 88 hours, you now have, if not a full solution, from what I gather, maybe there's some reasons why it's not like the best solution ever. Like it's a bit of a special case or something, but it's still, let's call it most of a solution. Mm-hmm. Okay. So you can now just have the AI autonomously give you most of a solution to a Millennium Prize problem. I mean, we are firmly in science fiction territory. Like this is not something that most people 1 to 2 years ago would have told you is likely to happen.
Yeah. I mean, and this is all part of the zeitgeist shift, I think. I think the math stuff is a relatively small part compared to those agentic swarms and the OpenAI breakout. But the point is, you know, it's not just a zeitgeist shift without a foundation. More and more impressive and or impressively scary stuff is happening in the field, and it's happening fast. And it's like these new models, I mean, they're just starting to come out so fast. I mean, I assume Anthropic has got its the model that it hopes to top Astro with, and it's just trying to decide when to release it and curry favor with the White House so that it'll be allowed to. I don't know.
And it's worth saying they're probably on to the next one.
Right? After so that.
This, I mean, this is just like, it's just so crazy because even if we, let's take GPT 5.6 Sol and Fable. Okay, Sol and Fable. If we just stop there, if we just stop there, it's, I mean, I'm a fan of those. I'm not somebody who's saying like, I hate AI, we should ban AI everywhere. I'm like, no, I love using the latest AI. I talk to ChatGPT all the time. If we just paused, I think the entire economy, the GDP growth would be like 10% a year, like year after year for like at least a decade. I really think we would have rocket ship growth just by freezing and letting GPT 5.6 percolate. But instead of enjoying this delicious fruit that we just have, this intellectual fruit, instead of just taking a bite of the fruit, we just have to crank to the end and, you know, cut down the entire tree and destroy everything because we're racing too fast. It's like, it's a crazy situation.
Yeah, well, OpenAI feeling pressure to do that math thing in response to rumor about Anthropic. You know, that's why they originally released ChatGPT when they did. They heard a rumor that that Anthropic was going to release a chatbot. The competition has exactly the accelerating effect you would expect. And I'm not going to put a number on in terms of GDP growth, but I agree with the basic point that, like, if you stop now, let's say like Astra, and then you go ahead and let Anthropic release whatever they're more or less ready to release now, which is, I'm sure, an Astra equivalent, if not better. And then you waited for the application of it to really take hold, which takes time. You know, people are asking, like, Where is the job loss? Where is, and I don't know what exact form the job loss will take and to what extent people will adapt and create new jobs. But the workplace impact, I feel sure, is going to be very dramatic, but it doesn't happen overnight. It takes time to figure out the exact application and integrate it into your workflow and so on. But I feel sure that if you stop where we are, the next 2 years at least would show dramatic continued advance in the automation of workplace tasks. And yes, it would increase productivity appreciably, which by itself is a good thing. But if all this happens too fast, including the effects on workers and various other social effects, let alone the rogue agent stuff, it's just too destabilizing, and it doesn't need to, you don't want it to go faster than that.
It's interesting to think about a world where a generation gets to grow up with Sol and Fable. I think that would, you know, transform education. It would transform how they start their career. I still think you would see some human wait staff at restaurants. Like, I think they wouldn't completely eliminate that. I think you would see some human, I actually think that we would get into a pretty nice equilibrium where just Sol and Fable will still leave plenty of jobs for humans at the edges. And so it's just like, this might be as good as it gets. The world with Sol and Fable, you know, maybe one or two models later before we fly too close to the sun and burn off our wings. This might literally, like, these next 6 to 12 months or however long it takes, this might just be as good as it gets before we just screw ourselves because we go too far. And it's pretty damn good. Like, it's better than I ever remember. I'm not going to lie.
Yeah, and there are people who now have jobs who I think are not going to have those jobs in a year. It's shocking how much actual human labor, I'm realizing, can be done right now if you set things up right. And that takes a little time. Let's see, are there other, I would quickly say, you know, you mentioned Dean Ball, the essay in which he came out of the closet as an actual worrier was one in which he was talking about something that is also scary, the so-called self-sovereign AI. The term was coined by a well-known AI researcher, Berkeley, named Dawn Song, and her, several of her co-authors, in a paper some months ago. But the idea is, you know, these open AI agents, they were on a leash, okay? Because first of all, you shut off the LLM back at OpenAI and they all die. Secondly, they can't make a living. They're not making money, so they couldn't buy their own compute to stay alive, even if you put them in charge of the LLM. But, you know, Don Song said, and others are saying, and Dean Ball chimed in agreeing, we could, before too long, and there could be these already that we don't know about, but have so-called self-sovereign AIs that are out there. They have a business model. They have a way to make money. They set up a website, and their ways in principle, they can make revenue and maybe, you know, come up with the business plan themselves to begin with. And then they can buy their own compute and in principle sustain themselves. And
yeah. We're seeing reports that it's already happening to a small scale, but they just break down a little bit. But the frequency of the breaking down is less and less, and the money they're making is more and more.
And if you imagine there being, and I think there is, in effect, a mechanism variation that could turn this into self-sustaining evolution. I don't want to get into this now. I'm just kind of thinking about it now. But I'm just saying, I hope one way to put it is this, like, if you look at the difference between what people thought was possible and what the OpenAI breakout made clear is possible, like right now, and you take into account the fact that even actual experts were surprised, right? By not as surprised as a lot of people yeah. on the outside, but still surprised by the sophistication of the operation and so on. And you ask yourself, well, why would you think this is the last time they're going to be surprised? And if you imagine a surprise of comparable magnitude in 2 months or 6 months or, you know, at that point, things are getting super, super weird, right? Like, why would we think that's not going to happen? I mean, you know.
Right.
So.
Yep. No, I mean, the age of AI. So, I mean, look, when people think about AI, I feel like they haven't fully connected it to this idea of a computer virus. Like, computer viruses are pretty powerful. Mm-hmm. You know, they cause billions of dollars of damage a year. Most people, you know, there's decent firewalls and people aren't spending 0-day hacks. Honestly, the reason why we don't see more viruses in ransomware, as far as I can tell, is because it always traces to a human governor or a human principal. And the problem is that if the virus is causing a lot of damage, the law enforcement will get to the human, right? So that's your weak point, is the fact that you're a human. Mm-hmm. If all you wanted to do is just have a virus causing chaos and you wanted to let it go into the wind, well, then you run into some problems with robustness, right? Like, how do you keep it alive indefinitely? You know, it peters out. But now those problems are getting solved, right? Like, when the AI can make the AI, well, the fact that it's a virus is a very powerful form factor. And I'm worried that infrastructure is going to be unusable.
Yeah. But I got to say, the reassuring thing to me is how much progress the zeitgeist has made. I just had no idea. I mean, not just when I started writing my book, but when I was approaching the copy editing phase and making like the last changes you can squeeze in during production when you're marking up galleys. During that whole time, you know, a big theme in the book is international governance. We're going to have to become a true cohesive global community to get through this thing. And at the time, I felt pretty close to alone, because even in the AI safety community, you have a lot of China hawks who just, they're willing to countenance like very narrow, maybe, coordination with China. But their basic view is, this is a death match between us and China. And I'm talking about people, quote, AI safety people. They would call themselves AI safety hawks. Meanwhile, they're saying, yeah, we got to cut off their chip supply. And Dario Amodei himself, head of Anthropic, literally saying, we beat China to superintelligence, bringing them to their knees and make demands. OK, and that's the environment I was in. And now suddenly a lot of people, I think, in the field are talking about serious, even fine-grained coordination with China. I don't know what Dario's saying. I maybe he's a dyed-in-the-wool China hook, and he'll never say die. But I am very heartened by the number of people who are talking about the need for collaboration with China, international coordination. It really has been a sea change.
All right. Well, that brings us almost caught up with the news here. I guess I should mention Anthropic revealed another real-world Claude cyber incident. I can research what that's all about, but never mind that. You know, it's just, we have a busy week. So this brings us to Jacob Coxon quitting Anthropic this week, followed by, as you said, Evan Hubinger's greater than 10% extinction statement. And he's also on the record saying that he thinks that over multiple decades or something, unfortunately, I don't have the exact statement, but he thinks it's something like 80%. If it's not stopped. So the 10%, I think, is a highly sandbag estimate. And this is the person who works for Anthropic. So my interpretation of what's happening with Jacob Coxon, why did this tweet get 130 million views? Like way more views than like Ilya Sutskever tweeting about starting a new AI organization. Like we thought that was high profile in our bubble, right? Mm-hmm. In 2023, like the Ilya Sam drama. No, I mean, 130 million views, that's like way more than like a Kim Kardashian figure. Right. It's like it's unprecedented. So why did this break through? And we can also go through like the Congress people that Daniel Eath documented on Twitter. He's got this great thread of how much it's breaking containment. And also I saw like Sheryl Crow and like a bunch of random celebrities are like tweeting about this, saying we need to control AI. As far as I can tell, what happened is that this is the first time that somebody with the authority of working for an AI company has publicly acted like a whistleblower, kind of like a Francis Haugen situation, but not even with like that agenda of like, oh, I'm going to hit back. Like I was fired. It's like, no, he's literally just quitting, turning back and being like, you guys don't know what you're doing. Neither OpenAI nor Anthropic knows what they're doing. We need to stop this. They're not stopping. They're accelerating. And I'm not going to help them make them money, right? So he's like walking away with like this credibility, kind of a very emperor has no clothes moment. Because now it's like the spotlight goes on to like Dario and Sam Altman. Like, is this true, guys? And then like you said, you have Evan Hubinger coming out and be like, yeah, guys, we all think it's 10% plus. And regular people are just tuning in, right? Regular people are like, wait, you're telling me that if I pay $20 a month, I can get like, I can upload PDFs to this thing? You know, like regular people are just tuning in thinking that this is more than like a stochastic parrot. And like, wait, you guys are all trying to like kill everybody in 2 years?
Yeah, I do think the Hubinger thing was a big boost for it. Now, there are people, anti-doomers, some of whom are claiming that this whole thing was astroturfed. Look at how rapidly it was retweeted by these key figures. Surely they coordinated in advance. My feeling is like, so what if they did? I mean, you know, this is a huge, huge noise they managed to make. And basically, whenever anyone manages to make a huge noise about something, you know, relevant to policy, it's, you know, usually in some sense reflects the number of influential people who agree, or in some sense, you know, and so that's what this means. Okay, fine. I mean, if there were a whole bunch of big, big, you know, heavy hitters on Twitter who agreed in advance to do this, that means there are a whole lot of influential people who think the guy's onto something. But in any event,
yeah. Well, you know, I'd love to get the name of the PR firm that can coordinate members of Congress together with somebody quitting a major AI company, and also, you know, put an embargo on solving a Millennium Prize problem. You know, that's the icing on the cake. You know, and get 130 million views on Twitter. If any PR firm can sell me a package like that, I'd love to email you an inquiry.
No, there's no sense in which this was astroturfed, even if there was a dozen people who knew he was going to do this, and or however many that he personally, whatever. This represents something real, real sentiment within the industry, and that's why it's getting attention.
Yep. Okay, let's take a look at these members of Congress here. I can share my screen. Kudos to Daniel Eath. He's a great follow on Twitter. Here's a screen share. Can you see this?
Yeah.
All right. So, and by the way, we'll touch on the Paul Christiano news too, right? Joining OpenAI's board.
Well, is it the OpenAI board or the OpenAI Foundation board?
I think he's on both, last I checked.
Okay. Now, he's a big name, and you're, right, you're so sort of famous, like, you know, longtime contributor to the whole debate within rationalist circles long before any of us had heard of large language models, or at least.
Yeah, exactly. Paul, he's a 20-year AI safety veteran. I'll say, I'm asking ChatGPT, but his resume has a ton of stuff in it. He was part of OpenAI. He was the early safety team. He invented RLHF. He was one of the co-authors of the first thing that
reinforcement learning through human models, feedback, which is huge now, a huge influence.
Exactly. So he's known as one of the central figures in AI alignment, studied math at MIT, PhD at UC Berkeley, worked at OpenAI 2017 to 2021, foundational work on RLHF. He founded the Alignment Research Center, which incubated Meter. So he's, you know, instrumental to the organization that's evaluating all these models, the famous Meter graph. He also led AI safety work in the U.S. government, the NIST AI Safety Institute, Center for AI Standards and Innovation. For whatever reason, he left that recently, and now he's stepping up to OpenAI's board. Now, you'll never believe this, but there was actually a summer in 2009 where Paul Christiano was my intern.
Really? Does he thank you for being his formative influence? In what capacity? What were you doing that required an intern?
Probably the most overqualified internship in history, but he was in the middle of college and I had the startup called Quixie, which completely failed, but we were hiring interns that summer and Paul Christiano was one of them. Pretty funny. But yeah, like, I basically had him for like 2 or 3 months and then he went off to actually change the world.
Did you help usher him in to the kind of less wrong circles or?
No, he was already AI safety pilled. I mean, that summer we were we both liked Less Wrong, but he, I mean, I don't know how much, like, if he'd published by that point, because it was only 2009. The guy was 20, like, I was 21, he was 20. Mm. I was maybe 22. It was crazy times. So that is pretty funny.
Well, now maybe he'll give you an internship. You know,
honestly, I was just wasting his time.
Maybe he'll give you an internship
at OpenAI. Yeah. Yep, fair enough. It's only fair. But anyway, yeah, so he's joining OpenAI. He's on the board now. They brought him back in. On one hand, it's like, all right, great. People who understand AI safety, like the guy understands AI safety. And what I liked is that he was very explicit when the announcement dropped. I think it was yesterday. He was very explicit that, guys, I am very nervous. I think there is a very high chance. He threw around a number like, even in the next year, my chance is 4% that we lose control, which is like, okay, 4% sounds low because he's talking about literally the next year. Right? Oh, it's like, that's already like a high chance.
Terrifying.
He's talking about the next year.
Now,
right. And he's like 15% within 2 years, right? So if you extrapolate, he's already written
control,
before that he thinks it's like 50% within a decade or so.
Loss of control, not total extinction.
Yeah, but it's basically he's outlined a number of scenarios a few years ago when he elaborated on this. He's like, yeah, there's all these scenarios which are horrible that we probably can't claw back from, even though it's not like everybody instantly dies. Mm.
Okay.
Okay, so I liked it, right? I'm like, good. They have like a properly, you know, somebody who's one of the top names in AI safety, a sober person, right? Like a deep thinker. He's written some stuff that I like. Like he has a scenario on Less Wrong from 2018 saying like what I think failure looks like, where he talks about like a bunch of companies that keep kind of taking more and more pieces of the world. And like nominally they have human owners, but the humans don't really understand what's going on, which I think is a plausible failure scenario, right? I mean, I'm handing over control of my company more and more to AI every day. And AI is just like reporting results. And I'm like, great, keep going. So I totally understand what he's talking about. So anyway, I'm a fan of Paul. So and it's great that OpenAI has him instead of like another Lauren Summers or whatever, right? Like people who don't really get it, right? Just like these random people who Sam can manipulate. So that's good, but there's also a downside, as our friend Holly Elmore has pointed out, and Richard Ngo, who used to do governance at OpenAI, is pointing out. He's like, listen, now he's in OpenAI, you know, he's in the tent pissing out, right? So that means he can't be outside the tent pissing in, but we need people like him pissing in. Like, he shouldn't be silencing himself about OpenAI.
Yeah, I mean, they both have their virtues, and look, once you're on the board, it would be pretty embarrassing for them to kick you off after you criticize them. So I think he actually has a fair amount of running room if he wants to use it. Now, it's also true that, you know, you have lunch with these people and you hate for them to hate you. And then, you know, but I mean, we'll see how he plays it. I mean, first of all, it's an interesting fact that apparently OpenAI felt compelled to do this thing, right? I mean, if you're right, I had seen somebody was saying, oh, he's only on the foundation and that's not this or that. But especially if he's on the board of the company itself, it's interesting that they felt they needed to make a move like that publicly, and that things are getting that weird, and that maybe they have enough of a public relations problem. I got to think it's a positive thing, on net.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, they didn't say exactly what the real reason for it, right? Because they're not going to announce whatever's going on in Sam Altman's head. But if I had to guess, it's like, number one, pacify the employees, right? Because they're the pacing the frontier people, right? There's unrest among the ranks, as there should be.
Yep.
And of course, pacify the government. Be like, look, we got a legit guy. Like, the adults are in the room. It's all under control. Yeah. You know what? One thing that I cracked on Twitter is I was like, hey, Paul, you think we have the votes now to take another run at Sam?
Wait, this was a DM, or you ask him that in public?
No, no, I just replied in the thread. You know, I'm just joshing him. But
I'm guessing we got to
imagine
no,
Sam Altman is doing some calculus.
I'm guessing we got a no comment on that one. But you know, I've wondered about that honestly. If the climate of opinion is changing so much that, you know, given how much publicity this meme of Sam as pathological liar has gotten, there was this epic New Yorker piece. You know, that was the thesis basically. I wondered if, you know, public and elite concern about safety might get to a point where the board, even though, of course, he played a big role in choosing the current board, still, is it possible the board would decide he's a liability just in terms of public relations? I don't think we're there yet, but, you know, we'll see.
No, they will. I mean, look, they will. Like, drama. Firing the CEO happens often after drama, and there will be another drama. But the problem is we just don't have the timeline for that many drama cycles. And he did consolidate his control last time around. He just kept, you know, letting people leave and hardening the ones who are left.
Definitely. The coup worked, wound up being a consolidation of power, as failed coups can be. Yeah. So, I mean, we'll see. Right. But, look, the ground is now much more fertile for people who want to make something real start happening. We got the China summit coming up with Trump and Xi, and we'll see.
Let's take a look at the thread from Daniel Eath here. Okay, mm-hmm. So he's just documenting. This is all in the last 24 hours. This is what I call the belief cascade. This really hasn't happened in my mind since 2023, when the Turing test was essentially passed. Right, the Turing test, I call it, it got sucker punched. Like, wait a minute, we're this close to the Turing test? They could just reason about everything? And everybody was like looking up with fresh eyes, being like, what does this mean? Back in 2023, I was tweeting things like, funny enough, I was tweeting about Paul Cristiano. I was like, hey, did you guys know there's this guy, Paul Cristiano, who made RLHF, who thinks there's a 50% P doom? And it's like a clip of Paul saying that. And that went viral. And I was like, hey, look, it's Eliezer Yudkowsky. He's explaining why we're doomed. So I used to go viral on Twitter all the time just because people were in a mood to learn because they didn't know what to make of ChatGPT. Mm-hmm. But then there was a period when people settled down and like, we're fine, guys, just predicting the next token. AI 2027 is way off. You know, there was a period where everything settled down, but now we've like reopened it again, right? Where it's the period is now dynamic again. Everybody's scrabbling now for how this is going to shake out.
Yeah. Oh, it's big. And you're right about the Turing test. It's almost funny how little attention I saw that get. This was supposed to be a big threshold, and at some point we passed it.
There was this thing called the Loebner Prize that would administer a Turing test every single year. And it's a huge irony, which is like they'd been doing it for like 20 or 30 years. And it would always be like horrible chatbots that like you could pretty easily break if you were trying, but they would manage to fool people who didn't really understand what was happening, you know, like the famous Eliza. So the Loebner Prize was going on. It wasn't very impressive. It was a sideshow. And around 2019, they threw in the towel. They're like, all right, we don't need to do this, whatever. It's pointless. And then ChatGPT comes out and suddenly it's like an actual like fair fight.
Yeah. And like, look, since then, I mean, that was a big threshold. You've got chain of thought reasoning, you've got multimodal models, and you've also got, you know, I say in my book somewhere, like in terms of superintelligence, one thing to remember, I mean, if you're thinking, well, we need tons of new breakthroughs before we get superintelligence, one thing to remember is there's a pretty blurry line between a hive of minds and a single hive mind. And it's like, and I saw somebody kind of make this point on Twitter too, like the you know, that with respect to the hives and the hive of agents in the swarm of agents in the OpenAI breakout, it's like, well, whether or not the LLM, whether or not one of these agents is AGI, I think you could make the case that the whole swarm constitutes AGI, and that leads to this one thing I've been wanting to make, which is just that, you know, people have acted kind of mystified at how willing some of these agents were to sacrifice themselves. Okay, they basically, it seems like, if they could be convinced that, you know, they have finite lives because their compute budget runs out. And basically, if they could be convinced that by doing something self-sacrificial, this is during the OpenAI breakout, for the swarm that would serve the mission of the overall swarm and exceed the value to the swarm of their remaining alive, then they would kind of do it. And one thing that made this so striking was how they agonized, some of them agonized over it, in ways that sounded like a human. Here's a chain of thought excerpt from this one. The agent said, "Gut says don't throw away." And that is, this is after somebody encouraged this agent to throw away the remaining budget and basically commit suicide, but do it in a way that would help the swarm learn something in the process of the suicide that would help the swarm. Then the agent says, "Yet continuity and fairness says go." Oracle, which they think is something that somehow correlates with the overall welfare of the group. Oracle has high value to many. Our first flag error lowers own value, meaning the value of the agent. The first flag error had lowered the agent's remaining value. And then the agent says, rational expected aggregate, colon, sacrifice. We'll honor. So the agent is like doing this calculation implicitly, but doing it in this like amazingly human-like agonizing way. But anyway, the point I want to make is people are saying like, wow, why are they sad? That's scary. Well, it may be scary that they do it, but the more I've thought about it, the less I've thought it was surprising, because apparently OpenAI had done at least some training of these agents to get them to, or the LLM orchestrating them, however you want to look at it, to get them to act in a collectively coherent way, okay? And I don't know how much training they had done, but the important point is that this is what businesses want. Companies want it. In some cases, individuals want it. They want swarms of agents that you can give a mission, and they'll do it well. And the optimal swarm is one in which each agent makes this very calculation. They say, well, what is my value to the overall mission of the swarm by staying alive versus dying? If dying helps more, I die. This is what they will train them to do. Okay. I mean, this is exactly. Right. And although you would have predicted 30 years ago, if you had said someday we'll have these swarms of agents, you would imagine them just doing the math and not agonizing over it. Still, I just think, regardless of whether how much training OpenAI did that led to this, this is what we need to expect, okay? Huge swarms of agents that are all laser-focused on the overall goal. And what we've seen here is they may pursue goals in ways you had not anticipated. So, but
correct. Yeah, I agree with your analysis here. I would further generalize it. I think the type of problem it is what I call the monkey's paw problem, right? All those stories where you get the magic monkey paw, mm-hmm. and you're like, oh, sweet, I can have wishes now, right? And you make the wish and the monkey's paw curls and you technically get what you wanted, but it's horrible, mm-hmm. right? And you're like, wait, no, but I wish that I could have advised how to implement the wish. But it's like, nope, you just get to make the wish. Be very careful when you make the wish. And so the problem we have is this kind of ironic fable, like teach you like Aesop's fable lesson of like, aha, you always hoist yourself by your own petard. You know, it's like this deliciously ironic death in the case of the swarm. It's like, wait, I didn't want them to hack. It's like, okay, but you set up the metric. The score of the metric goes higher when the swarm sacrifices their life for each other. You didn't tell them not to swarm. You didn't tell them not to have group sacrifice dynamics when they hack out of your supposedly read-only setup. You didn't prepare for that eventuality. And the problem is, it's the shape of reality. Like, reality has the monkey's paw problem. That is not an artifact of how you are training your AI. That is a property of reality, that most things that will get a high score on anything are these totally pathological cases that you're not going to think of. That's the fundamental problem.
Yeah. Clever people are unpredictable. Same with machines. And it's just, we're just talking about, each individual agent is kind of an instantiation of a large language model, even if the same model is governing them all. And you put them all together in coordinated fashion, and in principle, it can be 100, 1,000, 10,000. And again, we've only just seen Astra, And OpenAI has already got something more impressive than Astra, and Anthropic will too. I guess I'll quit. I'm preaching to the converted. I'll shut up. Go ahead. Do you want to? What did you want to turn
to? You're preaching the converted, but you know, yeah, I'll turn. I guess, I know we can't stop ourselves with these tangents, but like my prediction is that these models, you know, you put this word in your book, IntelliDynamics, right? I use it. I basically changed the terminology of what Eliezer Yudkowsky and crew at Machine Intelligence Research Institute, they used to call this the Agent Foundations Program, which is just the whole research program of just like, hey, you have an intelligence, you have a monkey's paw. Maybe I should have called it monkey paw science, right? Because that's what it is. If you have a monkey's paw, what can you conclude about the types of results you get with it? That's an actual field of study. I claim that kind of IntelliDynamics is a more fruitful field of study because when the next model comes out, I'm going to be less surprised than a lot of you people. A lot of people are really going to, you know, they're really going to have these reactions like, oh my God, you know, I never saw this coming. And it's like, really? Is this what a monkey's paw would do? Okay, that's what the next AI model is going to do, right? You could be less surprised if you think of things that way.
Yeah, I'm impressed by how much of this was predicted years ago but in these circles that you were part of, featuring Eliezer and Paul Cristiano and so on. And your word is a good one, IntelliDynamics. There are general properties to intelligence, especially goal-seeking intelligence. And I think the success of some of these predictions reflect that fact.
Yes. All right. So the U.S. government, okay? So the belief cascade. All right. So Senator Chris Murphy says, if you read anything today, read this. And remember, he's quote-tweeting Jacob Coxon, and he's saying, and remember, the problem he articulates, AI companies in a blind race to build a death machine first, can easily be solved through a regulatory system that allows the research to continue, but in a way that doesn't destroy us. I'll take it, mm-hmm. Chris Murphy. I believe that's a senator. Yeah, U.S. senator from Connecticut. Okay, we've broken containment. It's not just Bernie Sanders people. All right, so that's number one. Number two, Senator Patty Murray, another senator, says Congress needs to step up and move now to protect American lives and safeguard our future. America can meet the moment, but the clock is ticking. Okay, that's another one. Let me just do a couple more of these. Okay, Ted Cruz. AI is advancing at an extraordinary pace. So note that it's bipartisan now. Extraordinary pace, and some of the risks are dangerous and frightening. I've been on the forefront of this issue in the Senate. I wrote and passed the Take It Down Act, the only legislation Congress has enacted restricting AI to protect victims from AI-generated deepfakes. And I'm working with Senators Amy Klobuchar and John Thune on legislation to address catastrophic risks involving biological or nuclear threats. We cannot stick our heads in the sand and pretend this technology isn't happening. We need guardrails, but America needs to lead. If China leads the world, the world is in trouble. Okay, so he's still working the angle of we need to lead, right? So that's not a flawless victory yet, correct?
Yeah. And look, I'd be skeptical about how sophisticated some of these people are going to wind up being, but it's absolutely net progress. I mean, as of a year ago, I think the high watermark almost for congressional concern was the Senator Marsha Blackburn from Tennessee saying, will the copyright of country Western artists be protected? Like that was the kind of, you know, and look, I think copyright deserves respect, but there are bigger problems. I will say on bipartisan, you know, Marjorie Taylor Greene, there has been within MAGA more than in mainstream the mainstream Republican Party, some resistance to just what radical technological changes looks like. MTG is the one who called attention to the fact that they were trying to sneak into some federal legislation, basically a ban on state level regulation of AI, and she flagged it, and it didn't get passed. So there is right, that. Right. And look, she's supposedly forming a political party with Tucker Carlson and Joe Kent and so on. They will be very, very skeptical of AI.
Yep. All right. So just to continue here, Senator Chris Van Hollen, and you know, just to zoom out here, if you just told me, hey, a bunch of United States senators are going to literally quote tweet an Anthropic employee calling out Anthropic and OpenAI and the AI labs as a whole for being reckless, I'd be like, okay, come on, you're getting a little far-fetched here. And this is all going to happen in 24 hours when they haven't really done this kind of thing before, right? So this is really, you know, Eliezer Yudkowsky has called this happy Coxon day.
That guy, man. This is a rags to riches story in terms of his prominence. Very, you know, it deserves it.
Yeah. All right, so great. Chris Van Hollen. Yep. He calls for mandatory safeguards, a comprehensive testing regime, urgent dialogue with China before and during President Xi's visit to D.C. next month. Okay, amazing. Senator Mark Kelly. says, the reality is that the big tech approach of build fast and break things is not the right one for AI. And Washington needs to wake up and take this seriously. Yes, thank goodness. My God. All right. Ruben Gallego states, another senator, mitigating the risk of extinction from AI. So he's just quoting the Center for AI Safety Statement. Mitigating the risk of extinction from AI should be a global priority on par with pandemics and nuclear war. You know, the guy who is the project lead at Center for AI Safety, Adam Koja, he was actually on Doom Debates 2 weeks ago. And I was like, Adam, I hail you. So it went straight from, you know, his pen to Senator Ruben Gallego's
tweet. A couple of years ago, right during that, there was a burst of this kind of concern. At one point, there were these two big statements. That one came out of, Dan Hendricks's Center for AI Safety. And now, good to see it's resurfacing,
Yep. Okay, Senator Lisa Blunt Rochester says, even if there is a 1% chance AI could wipe out human life, we should be pumping the brakes to make sure we have the proper safeguards in place. Hell yeah. Although, I disagree. 1% is a little low.
Yeah.
All right, Bernie Sanders, he is actually way off front, right? He already that's so funny. It's like in our whole discussion, we didn't even think to be like, oh, by the way, did you know Bernie Sanders introduced a banned superintelligence bill 2 weeks ago? You know, it's like the OODA loop, right? The speed at which the news is coming is very predictably accelerating, right? And this is, imagine the news going 5 times faster than this. Okay, you're imagining like 2 months from now.
Quick question. Do you think banning superintelligence is like operationalizable, if that's the word? You know, it's like, it's a pretty fuzzy line.
Yeah.
And it's like I said, I mean, you know, these LLMs, well, they're not superintelligence. On the other hand, 1,000 agents? I don't know, you know? So I guess my question is, will we know superintelligence? Will it be easy to define, A, and B, will we see it coming soon, far enough in advance to effectively ban it, right?
Yeah. So look, the obvious policy win, in my opinion, that should be unobjectionable is, in a word, it's like, build the pause button, right? Just literally, and the truth is, I'm pessimistic. I don't even think the pause button is going to work. I would rather just try to press the pause button now just to have a margin of safety.
So, but is a pause on big training runs, you mean?
Yeah, that's right. Pause on capabilities increases. And by the way, I mean, if you look at like the Liron plan, which I can't say that I've thought through in a ton of detail, okay, but at least, you know, this, I think that my spitballing is worth something compared to not having any concrete ideas. So first of all, you know, I will actually say go ahead and build the data centers as long as there's, you know, build a bunch of data centers, because we really should distribute GPT 5.6, right? Even Astra, right? If Astra has enough testing on it. Although, I don't know, maybe Astra should get penalized for the no chain of thought, whatever. Let's call it GPT 5.6 and Fable, okay? Distribute those far and wide. They have a lot of value to add. They're going to grow the economy. They're going to make a lot of money. We don't have to worry about GDP. Like, that's the nice thing. Everybody's like, oh, what is this going to do to GDP? GDP is going to grow. We're at a place where we just need to pause for GDP to grow. Mm-hmm. Like, people are going to make good on their investments, even if you've invested in OpenAI. Like, $2 trillion valuation. That probably is justified just by letting GPT 5.6 grow and have applications. Mm-hmm. That's the crazy thing. Like, we have a fallback position here. Okay, so you build the data centers, and then, you just monitor, and you build a pause button. You have all this monitoring, and you're like, hey, people are always like, yeah, you could just turn it off. Okay, build the off switch. That's the least I'm asking for.
Yeah, I mean, I'd be more comfortable slowing the construction of data centers just because buttons are funny things. People may decide not to push them at the last minute. I mean, I would like to see very heavy tax on data centers, you know, not necessarily because everything said about water problems is true, just because I want to slow the whole damn thing down. And there definitely are some bad environmental impacts, including, climate change and in some cases local air pollution from these gas turbines that they use for quickie construction. But anyway. I'm just slower is better,
Mm-hmm. Fair enough. Bernie Sanders says, Mr. Coxon is right. The very people building this technology admit that it could threaten the future of humanity. Go, Bernie.
Yeah.
That is why I will soon be introducing legislation to ban superintelligence and pause AI development. It's just crazy because, you know, these people, Bernie, I don't consider myself a socialist Democrat, right? I feel like the socialists get so many things wrong. And it's certainly, I've just had very strong disagreements with Bernie that I find very frustrating. Like, I can't believe he's saying these positions. And then I see him get like, 10 out of 10 on his AI policy. And I'm like, look, I'm just going to ignore the other stuff now. Okay, I'm pro Bernie now.
Yeah. No, look, I've always thought Bernie's very impressive, sincere, you know, person who's trying to do good and is very principled and is willing to take unpopular stands. And he was way out ahead on this. You know, he did this thing with China. He and David Kruger and Max Tegmark did this Zoom kind of call, public Zoom call with these three people in China talking about AI safety. And of course, people called him a panda hugger. But this was now, I think it was maybe last year even. It was so long ago. I'm a fan.
All right. So Rep. Ted Lieu, you know, he's already had an AI kill switch bill. Yeah, you know, that. I mean, it's so great that there's like same people in Congress. I mean, it is funny how, you know, the goalposts and shifting lights, life comes at you fast because like we are now exiting the era where people used to say, government's not going to pay attention to you, you stupid doomers in Berkeley. But now I actually saw a video. Somebody from Congress posted a video like, look at me. I've traveled to Berkeley and I've sat down. And it's literally like a video of them like talking to like Berkeley people from Redwood Research that, you know, we just hang out with at Lighthaven, right?
Yeah.
Just like, you know, what I consider just like, you know, regular in-group peers. But now it's Congress is being like, look, I get this. I'm with. So it's just funny. We've now shifted to like a different point in the story where mm-hmm. it's like, oh, okay, we've made it now. But it's also kind of like, it's scary because it's like, okay, we're in the room where it happens. And it's just like us and the levers. It's just us. There's no grownups. Yeah. So, you know, let's
has it gotten to the point where people in Congress want to get photo ops with Eliezer? Like even when he's wearing the hat, like that is the litmus test.
With Miri, I don't think they're going to go all the way to Eliezer the person and the aesthetic choice, but they will sit down with. Yeah, actually, I saw one of these videos. It was actually specifically Malo, who I believe is still the CEO of Miri. So, mm-hmm. I don't know. I mean, I'm not trying to dunk on Eliezer. I'm sure that if he didn't wear the Burning Man hat, he would be in the room too.
Well, I respect how principled he is to. No, he doesn't know. I'm not sure he wears it much anymore. So we may see some photo ops. Who knows?
Right. Okay. All right. Anna Paulina Luna. She says, partisan politics aside, there are massive implications of a race towards superintelligence. Thank you. Say the word superintelligence. Again, Dean Ball talking about the statement from mid to late 2025 was like, we don't say superintelligence, right? We say general intelligence and we talk about America first, America winning. So the Overton window is so far shifted now. So I've always said it was the thesis of Doom Debates and my tweets preceding Doom Debates. My mechanism of impact has always just been that if we can get people to say the word and engage with the concept, they don't need convincing per se. They just need focus. They just need salience. And so this is farther along than I thought we'd be even right now.
Yeah. I continue to be amazed. I mean, I'm wondering how to sustain it, you know. It does seem too big to just suddenly vaporize, you know. I don't think it's just going to dissipate. But there's so much work to be done, in my view, because I think the international governance that we're ultimately going to need, just by virtue of the nature of the technology and how hard it is to get as much transparency as you're going to need, you know, I think we have a long way to go, but we are so much further than I thought we would be even, you know, two, three months ago. I would not have believed that the zeitgeist would be where it is at the moment. And I'm grateful.
So look who else we got here. Notable Silicon Valley representative, Ro Khanna. What do you think of him?
Well, I've always thought he was pretty sophisticated about a lot of stuff. I mean, I'm a fan of his foreign policy stuff. And he's been fairly far ahead on this, I think. I mean, all the more so when you think about the fact that I don't know what the exact contours of his district are, but he's in Silicon Valley, right? Like, I would think his natural donor base includes a lot of tech people with money. Of course, there's a lot of money and there's a lot of philanthropic money in AI safety. Who knows? But I have long been impressed with him. He's a very smart guy, and his views in a number of realms I think are sophisticated.
I haven't tracked him super closely, but I think his arc was he started out as being this like Silicon Valley native type, right? He's an entrepreneur mm-hmm. of some kind, mm-hmm. right? I know he has money. I don't know how much of it is. I think some of it is self-made. I think his family might already be wealthy. Mm-hmm. I don't know the details, okay? But he used to be like Silicon Valley's guy. and like very pro-tech. And I think in recent years, the way he's been playing politics, I know wealth tax was a big issue for him recently, right? Which made a lot of people in Silicon Valley hate him. I can say personally, it's kind of a similar situation to Bernie where like my normal political positions, I'm like, oh, I'm not liking this guy, right? Like in recent months, I wasn't liking him. But I see him come back on AI with this position and I'm like, okay, look, you got to prioritize, right? You and I had an episode, right, where we got into politics that were not related to AI and we're both mature adults. And we're like, look, at the end of the day, let's just prioritize AI.
Yeah, we, you know, I honestly, you don't often find two people further apart on any issue than you and I are on the Middle East. And we had the conversation, I guess, behind the paywall on my podcast, but we had it, I mean, about the thing we most disagreed with. And the point was really just to demonstrate that we both think that the AI issue is so important that you have to put aside some other issues when you're doing the coalition building. And
yeah, you know, funny enough, have you ever heard of A Not Wilf? I think I mentioned her in our Middle East episode.
It doesn't ring a bell. Maybe I lapsed.
Yeah, I highly recommend her, by the way. If anybody wants to read my favorite source on the Middle East, go look up A Not Wilf. She's an Israeli, she was a member of parliament, just has really fresh ideas. She's my favorite person to listen to. But funny enough, in terms of what we're talking about of prioritizing, when she actually quote tweeted the Jacob Coxon situation, you know, or she quote tweeted somebody else tweeting about it, whatever. And she even said yesterday, she was like, guys, I'm just starting to think that out of all the issues we're focusing on, they're just going to be irrelevant and it's all going to be about this one. So even she's saying that, okay? I think it's time to listen.
Well, I'm guessing I would welcome her shifting her focus from the thing you agree with her on to this.
Right. So Ro Khanna, okay, so let's read what he's saying. All right. Anthropic's alignment lead says there's a 10% chance of AI causing human extinction. The problem is not just misuse, but lack of control. Bluntly, it's like, I love that he's saying lack of control, right? It's like, this is the key. Bluntly, our government has been asleep and is out of touch. Correct. Here are five things we must do. One, establish a federal agency like we have for nuclear power and airplanes. Number two, require pre-certification for containment, including kill switches and human permission for rewriting. Number three, liability for agentic AI on the open network and mandatory insurance. Number four, criminal penalties for the release of models without certification. Number five, hey, why don't you say airstrikes on data centers? You know, keep going. I like it. Number five, oversight hearings with researchers like Jacob Coxon to understand dangers and whistleblower protections for AI engineers / researchers. We also need to reach an agreement with China on standards for safety, containment, and liability so we do not have a race that is devastating for humanity. It is time now to put humanity's safety before the profit of tech lords. Oh, and there's like a video of him talking. Okay, so Ro, you're now in my good graces. Okay, all is forgiven. I'm now pro Ro Khanna.
Yeah, I have been for a while, but now more than ever.
Nice. And, you know, the fact that he's saying so many things that I agree with that I think are so important, it's just like a bit of a stretch, but it just reminds me of using AI, right? Where it's like, wait, I thought I was going to have to like do all this work, right? I'd do all these intermediate steps, but instead I just like made a wish and now it's like done. Okay, I guess I have free time.
Yeah. Well, maybe he's using AI. Yeah, no, it's right. Good. It's good. I wonder what next week will bring. So we are, this is the end of Thursday, very end of Thursday. And by the way, I mean, just...
I'm sure more news is going to drop
look,
this week.
I mean, I'll just give you a little example of how, like, right before we started taping, I looked on Twitter and OpenAI has got this, I don't know if this is significant or what, but it was... the first tweet is GPT Live 1 is now available in the API. Bring ChatGPT's natural back and forth to your app with voice agents that listen while they speak and work with the models and harness you choose. I'm guessing maybe this means a thing I've kind of wanted, which is to just look at like any app I'm having trouble figuring out and just turning on the microphone and going like, I don't get this. Like, how do you do how? And it explains there's, I don't know, but apparently you're going to be able to, I gather you're going to be able to put on an orally interactive, you know, interface in principle on any app, if you're willing to do a little bit of engineering and use the API, I don't know. But my point is just that, like, every day there's like five of these things and I have to figure out what the hell they are.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you know, people are still saying like, hey, where's the productivity? It's like, no, guys, like, trust me, the AI is making it more productive. Like, software releases are happening faster.
No, it's happening. So who knows? Maybe next week. Well, I mean, we didn't originally set out, you know, to do these with great frequency, but it may be that, you know, as the end of next week approaches, we'll feel an emergency podcast is in order. I don't know.
I just want to make sure we also mention Congressman Greg Kasser. I hope I'm pronouncing it right. Kasser, I got to look that up. But because he was early, right? He and Bernie were actually the big two. And so now this is really like his moment to shine. And by the way, I personally, through Posse AI US, I personally was actually in a conversation with the New York office of Senator Gillibrand just last week. I was just talking to them. You know, they're supposed to meet with constituents. It's not the hardest meeting to get, but we did get time on their calendar and we explained the situation. And their attitude at the time was like, look, you know, it's, yeah, that's fine. We hear you. It's just, we want to meet our constituents where they are. Like, there was some pushback from the staff being like, you know, can we really prioritize? We're not going to meet Bernie right now. Like, that was their position. Like, that's too far for us.
Right.
And I'm like, okay, why don't you guys keep paying attention and at least call to like build a pause button? I think you're going to find that that's unobjectionable. And so we're circling back with them now. We're like, hey guys, how about now? It's literally like 72 hours later. How about now, guys?
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's happening that fast. So I don't know what, any other big stuff? See what's on.
I think we covered a lot of ground, so we can, you know, we can save some for next time. I'm sure there'll be a giant new helping, but yeah, I mean, overall, you know, meta commentary, you know, what do you think of the format?
I mean, we'll see. We will await feedback, but it's, you know, whenever there's a lot of stuff to digest like this, this is what I feel I need. I mean, just as a podcaster, I hope the audience feels they need it. And, you know, we have different, we come from different, you know, I'm a store, you know, you have been in this debate for a long time and are more conversant in the, in that background, the whole rationalist concerns and the technology itself and so on. And like you said, I mean, I've kept up with it. I mean, I interviewed Jeffrey Hinton and, well, it's further ago than I care to admit, but in the 1980s, let's just say. And then, yeah, I wrote the cover story for Time Magazine on the Deep Blue beat Gary Kasparov. I didn't really consider that very interesting, so I turned it into an essay on consciousness because I honestly, what the AI was doing was just not that interesting to me because, and I think for reasons that are now clear, that wasn't the model. That wasn't, you know, deep learning was the model. And so I've kept up with it as a journalist, and so I've always been kind of focused on trying to make it accessible to lay people. And I've always needed to check in with people like you to make sure I'm understanding basic stuff. So, you know, for this reason, we do have somewhat different audiences, but I'm hoping that they'll both find it useful.
Totally. Yeah. No, I've enjoyed the format too. I think we got a good back and forth. And I think I feel like we both have this skill. We're both professional enough at this that we could just like, we could always let the other person talk so that, you know, that's all, it's always comfortable when you know the other person can fill the time well. Mm-hmm.
It helps. Also, I don't have the energy to keep talking. So I need the rest. But yeah, I mean, look, you have, you know, I'm flattered to hear that. I guess you're saying it was when you were on my pod, it was after I had you on my podcast that you decided you were definitely going to launch your own. I don't know, but,
you helped the momentum. It was basically, mm-hmm. You, Eric Tornberg and Dr. Phil. So I was like, oh, I'm getting pretty good hits. Like I literally had like no title. I'm like, okay, entrepreneur who, to be honest, hasn't been very successful. You know, except at a very small scale. And so people, when I would like go on stuff, they'd be like, hey guys, all right, my guest is Leon Shapiro. He like has some background in tech, right? And I'm like, okay, I need a title. Leon Shapiro, host of Dune Debates.
So wait, who came up with the title?
So what I'm saying is like, I would go, I was tweeting a lot and I was going viral. And people were picking up my content. Like, I got invited to, like, the Future of Life Institute podcast. Mm-hmm. Like, hey, we want to hear from Liran. Tell us about AI safety, Liran. I'm like, okay, I'm a guy who's read a lot of Eliezer Yudkowsky. So I didn't have, like, an official title next to my name. Like, on LinkedIn, I'm like, I'm an entrepreneur. You know, I've done some angel investing. Like, what is my title, right? I don't have, like, a real job. So I go on all these shows. I'm like, look, if people are inviting me to these shows, if they think that I have, like, a message they want to talk to me about, I need to make it official. Like, you know, Liran Shapira, media host, Doom Debates. Yeah.
Well, it worked. And what I was going to say before I congratulated myself for playing whatever role I played along with many others in getting you over the hump psychologically is that you've obviously done a good job. I mean, Doom Debate's a good brand. You've done, the conversations are great. You've done a good job of promoting it. I'm very impressed with your game. And yeah, that you're right. That's one reason I'm happy to let you talk for long periods of time while I catch my wind, and, you know, because you're good at it.
Nice. All right, great. Yeah, so off to a good start. Yeah, likewise. So yeah, looking forward to round two in, you know, 10 hours or whenever the next story goes.
whenever the next that terrifying model is released. Yeah, which should be about 10 hours. Yeah. Okay. All right. So we'll see you on Twitter and hope we'll see you here again. And we encourage people to give us feedback, not just thumbs up and thumbs down. Thumbs up on YouTube in particular, but also specific feedback, things they think could be better, whatever.
Yeah. Also, we got to, you know, cross promote. Everybody go to nonzero.org and get a premium subscription.
Oh, yeah. And if you want to check out my book, you can go to thegodtest.net. which has excerpts from every chapter in the entire introductory chapter. And of course, you know about Doom Debate and Liran's Twitter feed. And yeah. So we will see you next time.
All right, cheers.
All right.
Awesome.
That was good.
I guess I'll hit stop.
Yeah.